Welcome to your weekly constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier in Orange, Virginia. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject today is, well, it's kind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll comes to mind. We're not going to talk about sex today. We'll do that some other day. And rock and roll may figure a little bit on the margins, but what we're really going to talk about is drugs, and specifically one drug that many of you have a great interest in. It's called marijuana, or if you prefer, cannabis. It actually goes by a number of names, but you know what we're talking about. How does this figure into the Constitution? Well, you've probably noticed that many states across the nation, notably California, have adopted so-called medical marijuana statutes. And those states have actually, at least in limited circumstances, decriminalized or even legalized the production, the sale, the consumption of marijuana. How can they do that? Because the federal government has not done that. How can something be illegal under federal law and yet perfectly legal under state law? Now, there is a constitutional issue. In fact, we've got a name for such conflicts. We call it federalism. And there's a whole area of constitutional law that studies the interaction between federal power on one side and state power on the other side. There's also a related concept called preemption, which you'll hear about. But let's get to the drug part first. Let me tell you how I got interested in this. There's a show that was lately on the Discovery Channel. It was called Weed Wars. And it started, I believe, last December of 2011. And though I'm not a big fan of reality shows generally, I started watching it, and I was absolutely and immediately hooked. The star of the show is a fellow by the name of Steve D'Angelo, and he runs a cannabis distribution center out in California, in Oakland, California. And we were fortunate enough to talk to Steve some time ago. So let's let him tell you about his experience before we get to all the constitutional stuff.
Well, you know, I've been a cannabis activist my entire adult life. I encountered the plant when I was a teenager and immediately knew that it was a good plant, not an evil plant. And I'm just one of those lucky people who knows at an early age what they want to do. And for me, it was cannabis. I knew the plant would play an important role in my life.
Well, I have to stop you there then. So you were a teenager, you discovered cannabis, what most people would refer to correctly or incorrectly as marijuana or pot or something like that. You discover this, and did you just turn to your parents and say, gee, Mom and Dad, I wanna smoke pot and grow it for a living?
Oh, yeah. My decision to embrace cannabis definitely led to conflict, not just with my parents, but with school authorities and ultimately with the police.
But this became a cause for you after that conflict erupted, I guess.
It did, because what I learned was that, you know, I knew on an intuitive basis it was a good plant. But then as I started studying and digging into the science behind it, everything that I learned confirmed what my original intuition was. And so I really became dedicated to bringing the truth about this plant to the world.
Well, let's start at that point then. Tell us, what is the cannabis plant? You know, where does it grow? What's its history? Why is it a good plant?
Well, you know, the cannabis plant has been a part of human civilization and culture for as long as there's been human civilization and culture. Some of our earliest historical artifacts come from that plant. One of the earliest pieces of woven textiles in existence is a piece of woven hemp textiles. Similarly, if you look at Chinese medical texts, old Ayurvedic Indian medical texts, human beings have been using cannabis as a medicine, as a fiber, as a fuel, as a food for literally thousands and thousands of years.
Well, now differentiate for me. Now, I hear about hemp, but I hear about that as a material being used, as you say, as a fiber. How does that differentiate from the sort of cannabis you're talking about at the Harborside Health Center?
The cannabis that we have at Harborside is medical cannabis. So the cannabis that we have is grown specifically for its medical purposes. We have both THC-rich varieties of medical cannabis and CBD-rich varieties of medical cannabis, the former having more of a psychoactive effect, the latter having a greatly diminished psychoactive effect, but still very effective on a therapeutic level.
So there are other varieties of cannabis then that might be used for these other uses that don't have anything to do with pain relief or with psychoactive effect.
Yeah, exactly. The CBD-rich medicines that we have are very effective for inflammation. They're very effective for anxiety. They're very effective, actually, for pain relief. So there are many different types of cannabis. We're really just beginning to learn about the plant.
Okay, well, now I'm not contradicting anything you've said because, quite honestly, I'm quite ignorant of all of this stuff. But now, if, in fact, all these positive properties exist, then why do you believe there's so much resistance within the medical community, within the FDA, certainly within law enforcement, to for medicinal uses for this?
Well, you know, what we're really seeing is that the medical establishment is increasingly embracing medical cannabis. We just saw the California Medical Association embrace the idea of cannabis. Last year, or the year before, we saw the American College of Physicians endorse medical cannabis and call on the government to reschedule it. The California Nurses Association has long been a supporter of medical cannabis. And a AMA advisory committee has said that they believe that cannabis should be rescheduled to have medical uses. So it's really the government that's out of step with the science on this issue. And the reason that you see the issue going to the ballot box is that the DEA will not allow the FDA to research or regulate cannabis. That's the problem.
Really? I mean, if somebody from some scientist says, I'd like a grant to research the medical uses of cannabis, that the DEA will say, well, yeah, that's fine, but we're going to arrest you?
Well, in fact, they will not give that physician a license to study cannabis. The DEA only gives licenses to study the harms of cannabis. They will not give licenses to study the benefits of cannabis.
Very interesting. Well, now, shifting focus just slightly, please give us a brief history of the Harborside Health Center.
Mm-hmm. Well, I launched Harborside Health Center 5 years ago to serve as a model of best practices for the industry, a model of transparency, responsibility, and legal compliance. So when I opened Harborside, there were basically two types of medical cannabis dispensaries in California. The first, which had been started by well-meaning activists who were long on good intention but very short on startup capital or professional experience. And they put together often very amateurish shops. Despite that, they thrived because it was the only place that patients could go to get medicine, in turn attracting a second wave of dispensary operators who I call the thug operators, often came from sort of unsavory backgrounds, and were mostly interested in making as much money as they could, as quickly as they could. And I looked at that situation and decided there had to be a better way, that we could put together a medical cannabis dispensary that would really show the world that cannabis could be distributed in a way that brings benefits rather than harms to communities.
I must say, when I watch the television set, it doesn't look anything like the head shops of yore. In fact, it looks more like, I guess, just a usual sort of pharmaceutical place. Actually, it looks better than most pharmacies I've seen.
Yeah, you know, we tried to create a physical environment at Harborside that would be really welcoming to the wide diversity of patients we tracked. We didn't want someone to feel like they had to be a punk rocker or a Rastafarian or a Grateful Dead head in order to feel comfortable at Harborside. So we intentionally created an environment where everybody would feel comfortable.
Part of the fascination of the show is wondering just when the DEA is going to come in with their battering rams and shut you down. Do you have any sense that the feds are going to target you, maybe especially because you are on this television show?
Sure. You know, when we agreed to do the show a year ago, the federal government had an entirely different policy towards medical cannabis. At that time, the Obama administration said they were going to respect state medical cannabis laws. Unfortunately, in the middle of the year, the Obama administration changed their tune and is now saying that they're going to prosecute people like Harborside Health Center. So we didn't know when we agreed to do the show what danger we were putting ourselves in. And, yeah, you know, I don't know when I come to work in the morning whether I'm going to go home at night or whether I'm going to go to federal prison. It's quite terrifying.
I imagine it is. I certainly don't mean to make light of it, but I mean that really is part of the fascination of the show. You all obviously are taking enormous risks by doing this because, as you point out, you're completely outside of federal law, even though you're operating within California law. So I mean, you, your brother, perhaps other family members, certainly your coworkers could all end up with long prison sentences. Do you have any? Do you have any sense what are the chances that something like that might happen?
Well, you know, the federal government can come here and they can raid us and they can arrest us, but only a jury of our peers can convict us. And I don't think anybody in the Bay Area of California thinks that Harborside Health Center is a drug trafficking organization. I'm confident that a jury of my peers would acquit me of any charges like that.
Well, finally, we get to a legal concept. What you're talking about is, of course, something called jury nullification. And it has a long and storied history in our country, and there are those who think it's a very important constitutional check on the power of the state. And in fact, that's kind of what I had thought you might be thinking when I was watching your television show, is that, you know, the feds can come and prosecute, but unless they get a change of venue, it doesn't seem to me likely that they would be able to get a unanimous verdict against you either.
Exactly, and that's what I've always counted on. You know, I've believed that if the American people got a good look at what we were doing, at the way that my staff, myself, handle the medicine and treat our patients, that they would support what we're doing. And at the end of the day, that's what I'm relying on for our personal security and safety, is that our fellow citizens are going to stick up for us and do the right thing.
Yeah, I was about to say that the TV show makes you a target, and that's true, but it also might be Exhibit A through Z at whatever trial you might be put into.
Yeah, exactly, and I just, you know, I'm so firmly committed to the idea that Americans deserve to see what's going on here. They really need to see what's going on here, and, you know, like the child who was in Episode 2, where are parents and children going to be who rely on Harborside Health Center for a safe place to get medical cannabis if we're closed? It's just horrifying to think about.
Were you talking about the little boy with the seizures?
Yeah, exactly. We have a patient, a five-year-old boy, Jaden, who gets grand mal seizures every single day unless he uses CBD-rich cannabis, which we've supplied him with. It's been tremendously, tremendously effective. It's totally changed this little boy's life.
Okay, I was going to ask you that. I didn't know if you'd want to give away anything for later episodes, but I was curious as to whether that was effective. So it's working for Jaden, is it?
It is. He now is down to about one seizure every couple of weeks. The seizures are much less severe than they were, and they're much less long-lasting than they were. He's now able to go to school and participate in classes much more effectively. He's smiling and even singing.
Well, that's very good. I'm very glad to hear that. Now, speaking about the Constitution, which is, of course, the focus of my particular show, there are two constitutional issues here, one of which I think you've already mentioned in your TV show, which is the issue of states' rights. And we have a conflict here, on the one hand, between California law and between federal law. Could you comment on that conflict and how you'd like to see it resolved?
Yeah. You know, the conflict is that the federal government, despite a huge amount of evidence, refuses to recognize that there's medical use for cannabis, whereas in 16 states and the District of Columbia, voters have voted to recognize the medical uses of cannabis. That's the basic conflict that exists. And the way for it to be resolved is for the Drug Enforcement Administration to do what its own administrative law court judge has ordered it to do, which is reschedule cannabis from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. Now, there's a very clear, bright line for standards of Schedule 1 substances or Schedule 2 substances. Any substance, by law, which has a recognized medical use must be classified as Schedule 1. The persistent refusal of the DEA to do this in the face of a huge amount of evidence is what has engendered this voter uprising and rebellion.
Okay, now what's the difference between Schedule 1 and Schedule 2?
Well, there's huge differences in terms of federal sentencing. You get much, much longer sentences for a Schedule 1 than you do a Schedule 2. Schedule 2 drugs also are allowed to be researched, so it would be legal for people to research the benefits of cannabis as well as the harms of cannabis if that switch were made. Most importantly, the switch to Schedule 2 would enable those states which have passed medical cannabis laws to effectively regulate the industry. We have a terrible situation in California now where cities and counties have regulated the cultivation and distribution of medical cannabis, but then you have the federal government coming in and invalidating those regulations and refusing to allow local jurisdictions to pass their own regulations. And moving to Schedule 2 would empower the states and cities to regulate the industry properly.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Many people who often describe themselves as conservatives, and so arguably would generally speaking be in favor of the so-called war on drugs, are at the same time people who tend to champion states' rights. But this is one of those circumstances where there's a conflict between the two. The states here are trying to do something that conservative people might disagree with, and yet they might claim the same right as a state to go their own way that states sometimes do for more conservative causes.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always thought that one of the attractive things about the conservative movement was its consistency and adherence to principle. And I've honestly been quite disappointed that the conservative movement has not raised a huge uproar over this issue. In fact, the Obama administration is using medical cannabis rulings to justify Obamacare, which I think is a perfect illustration of the danger of the conservative movement or any of us departing from our principles.
Very interesting. Could you go into a little bit more about that? I don't understand exactly what you mean. How is the Obama administration using it to justify Obamacare?
Sure. Well, you'll know that Obamacare is being challenged in several appellate courts right now.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cases that the administration is using in those, one of the precedents that the administration is using in those cases is a case called Raich versus the United States.
Gonzalez versus Raich, right, yeah.
Gonzalez versus Raich. That was the case which established that the federal government has the right to continue to keep medical cannabis illegal, even
mm-hmm.
though states have passed these laws. And now the Obama administration is using that case as justification in their arguments for Obamacare.
Yeah, that's actually a case. And in fact, now I see where you're going with that. In fact, we're doing a show also very shortly here on that health care law. And the argument in the Gonzalez case was that the commerce power, which is the basis for both the drug law and for the health care law, is broad enough so that the federal government can regulate any market, whether it's the healthcare market on the one hand or whether it is the market in so-called illicit drugs on the other. So now I see where you're going with that. Interesting how these things shake out, isn't it? You think you know how one side or the other will go with it, but then you find conservative people arguing against states' rights and perhaps more liberal people taking up the states' rights banner.
Yeah, some very strange bedfellows here for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one other constitutional issue, of course, that crops up in discussions of any drug prohibition, beyond just prohibition itself, which, as you know, has a constitutional history, a prohibition of alcohol, is the issue of individual rights. Do you have any feeling that your individual rights would be violated by the feds coming in and busting down your doors?
Well, you know, I think that the individual rights of anybody who uses cannabis have been violated by the federal government for the past 70 years. I think it's just absurd to think that in the United States of America that the government would be able to proclaim a plant illegal and regulate what people put into their own bodies. Is there a greater example of the nanny state than someone, a government official, coming along and saying, no, you can't plant that plant in the garden. No, you can't consume that plant. I think it's just an outrageous abrogation of individual rights.
That's an interesting argument, and I certainly can see your point. And again, on your TV show, you make a very good point of, you know, showing that this is, you know, it's a plant and it looks very much like any other plant. But of course, the response to that would be that the coca plant is the source for cocaine, and of course the poppy plant is the source for opiates like heroin. Does that same argument apply to those drugs as it does to cannabis?
No, because the evidence for the medical efficacy of those drugs is much weaker. If you take a look at the biochemistry of the cannabis plant, what you find is that it is part of a receptor system in the human brain. The human brain produces many of the same chemicals that you find in the cannabis plant, and the receptor system that controls and modulates those chemicals is called the endocannabinoid system. It happens to be the largest neurotransmitter system in the human body. So there's a very sound scientific basis for saying that cannabis is actually a good plant, that it has beneficial uses. Whereas if you take a look at cocaine and heroin, they're clearly far more dangerous and toxic substances.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about pot, we're talking about marijuana, we're talking about cannabis and how it fits into the constitutional framework of our nation. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Steve DeAngelo, the star of the Discovery Channel's Weed Wars.
Have you ever met that funny reefer man? Have you ever met that funny reefer man? If he says he swam to China, wants to sell you South Carolina, then you know you're talking to that reefer man. Have you ever met that funny reefer man? Oh, that funny, funny, funny reefer man. If he trades you dimes for nickels, he says watermelons are pickles, you know you're talking to that reefer man. Or have you ever met that funny reefer man?
Gang, it's time for the Constitutional Quiz, and Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady, is here from James Madison's Montpelier. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Stuart.
Absolutely. Now, get out your pen and paper and get ready to play along. Do we have a contestant?
I'm Adam. I'm from Philippi, West Virginia.
Philippi, West Virginia? Where is Philippi?
It's actually the first land battle of the Civil War up near Morgantown, West Virginia.
Really? I didn't even know that. Well, we'll have to look into the Battle of Philippi at some point.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Okay, Adam, are you ready for the quiz?
Yes.
Kelly, give it to him.
All right, Adam. I hope you like getting into the Sixth Amendment and some of the rights that are in part of that.
Sixth Amendment.
All right, here we go. In addition to guaranteeing a jury trial, the Sixth Amendment also provides that the accused in all criminal prosecutions shall enjoy the rights of A, to be informed of the nature of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to obtain witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
No, wait, that's all in A?
That's all in A.
Okay.
Adam, we're going long. That's why you got to have your paper and pen ready.
We're going long. Well, don't worry. We'll go back over them.
Yeah.
What's B?
Yeah. B, to attempt to plea bargain down to a lesser charge, to apply any days spent in jail prior to a conviction towards time served, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
That's B.
C, to act as his own counsel for the defense or to seek assistance for same. And D, to challenge the impartiality of the judge, jury, or prosecutor, to challenge the law under which he is being tried, and to seek assistance in his defense.
Okay, I know we're going to need to hear those one by one. So, Adam, just
would you mind to read the question again also?
Absolutely, okay. Adam, absolutely. In addition to guaranteeing a jury trial, the Sixth Amendment also provides that the accused in all criminal prosecutions shall enjoy the rights of A, to be informed of the nature of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to obtain witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
That's A.
That's a mouthful.
What do you think of A, Adam?
I actually think the answer is A.
Okay, you like that one, huh? Okay, that's just, it sounds like a pretty good laundry list of things. I'd like all those things.
I like all those things.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So here, let's try B. B, to attempt to plea bargain down to a lesser charge, to apply any days spent in jail prior to a conviction toward time served, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
I do not think it is B.
How come?
I don't think plea bargaining is express constitutional right in the Sixth Amendment.
That sounds very impressive. It's not an express constitutional right. It's not actually in there. Okay. Oh, that's
Morgantown, West Virginia friend.
Yes, and indeed, Philippi.
Philippi, that's
Philippi.
Right. Close. Yes.
Come on, that's where the battle was.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Go on. So let's see.
C, to act as his own counsel for the defense or to seek assistance for the same.
Well, the right to counsel is a right under the Constitution, but and I think you have a right to act as your own counsel, but I don't think that's expressly enumerated either.
Okay. What about D?
All right. D, to challenge the impartiality of the judge, jury, or prosecutor, to challenge the law under which he is being tried, and to seek assistance in his defense.
And again, I don't think challenging the impartiality of the judge is expressed in the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution.
It sounds like
I'm gonna stick with A.
Sticking with A.
I think that sounds like some things that are in the Sixth Amendment. Hopefully.
Well, it's this sounds like a theme here, is that we've got this laundry list, and each one of them is fairly lengthy.
Yeah.
And essentially it boils down to whether Adam knows what's in there, or because a lot of these things sound good.
They all sound great.
They sound really good, so the question is whether they're actually in the Sixth Amendment or not. And you're going to stick with A, are you, Adam?
Yes.
Well, Kelly, what do you say?
Adam, well done.
That was a very tough question because there were lots of things in there, like plea bargaining, which people do all the time, and, you know, like representing themselves, which they do all the time, and, you know, maybe even our constitutional rights, but they're not specifically mentioned in the Sixth Amendment, and so you got the answer correct, and you get your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
I will wear it always.
Excellent.
Wash it occasionally. It looks better.
I will wash it once a week, whether it needs it or not.
Okay. Thank you very much, Adam. We appreciate your time.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm.
It's your weekly constitutional. Let's continue our discussion with Steve D'Angelo, the star of the Discovery Channel's Weed Wars, who thinks that cannabis is a good plant.
It's not a dangerous substance. You know, I think there should be a rational relationship between the danger of a substance and its accessibility or availability. And substances which are more dangerous should be more highly regulated. Substances which are less dangerous should be less regulated. In the case of cannabis, we have over 10,000 years of recorded human history with not one fatality. So it just seems totally crazy to make the laws about cannabis more restrictive than they are for alcohol or tobacco, which demonstrably kill millions of people every year.
Very interesting. So then you are not a person who would argue in favor of the legalization of all drugs, plant-derived or synthetic. This is a very specific advocacy for this one plant.
Yes. You know, my advocacy on this issue is really limited to cannabis. I'm not an expert on any other substances. This is what I've studied and what I know and what I can speak to with authority.
All right. Can you give us any hints about what lies in the future on in the program?
Oh, sure. Episode 3 is going to focus on a patient with muscular dystrophy who has a real struggle coming to terms with the idea of using cannabis that then finds it very, very useful. We also have a very, very moving story of an employee who is very close to me personally who was caught misappropriating funds and had to be terminated.
Ooh.
And so you'll get to see all of that in up-close living detail. And then in the fourth episode is really going to focus on my theory, which is entitled Wellness, Not Intoxication, where I'll be talking about the wellness uses of cannabis as opposed to regarding it as an intoxicant.
Okay. Anything else you'd care to add before we conclude?
Well, you know, since many of your listenership are conservatives, I'd just like to say that there are a number of issues connected to cannabis that I think conservatives should ponder. You know, over the last several years, the legal medical cannabis industry has been responsible for about $1.7 billion a year in sales. That's $1.7 billion that's been extracted from the criminal economy, from street gangs, and from Mexican cartels. We've also created tens of thousands of well-paying jobs and generated hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. The upshot of all of this is that we have limited the power of the Mexican cartels and the criminals, reduced the burden on law enforcement, increased the law enforcement resources that are available to deal with real issues and made our communities safer. So I think if you take a look at the issues conservatives are concerned with, public safety and order, fiscal responsibility, border security, all of these things would be massively improved by the single step of regulating and taxing cannabis. So I would urge all conservatives out there to take a second look at this issue.
Very interesting. May I ask you a specific question about cannabis processing itself?
Sure.
Now, this springs from my own ignorance. I had always thought that it was the leaves of the plant that were going to be dried and ground up and smoked or consumed in some other fashion, but all of the visuals on your TV show the flower of the plant being the essence of it. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The flowers of the cannabis plant are the part of the plant that has the largest concentration of cannabinoids, or those chemicals that are medically or psychoactively useful. The leaves of the plant actually contain far lower concentrations of those chemicals. So the most useful part of the plant are those great, big, beautiful flowers that you see there.
Very interesting. Well, now this is an issue that is going to be on the front pages and is going to be discussed for a long time, I'm sure. So I hope it'll be okay if we give you a call later on and check in from time to time.
Absolutely. Always pleased to speak on the issue. Thanks so much for having me.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been talking to Steve DeAngelo from the Discovery Channel's Weed Wars about medical marijuana in California. Let's take a minute now and do our Madison Minute, after which we'll discuss this subject some more with a lawyer who knows a lot about it. Stay tuned.
55 men attended the Constitutional Convention of 1787. 34 were lawyers, 8 had signed the Declaration of Independence, and more than half were Revolutionary War veterans. Madison's best friend, Thomas Jefferson, was not at the convention, but overseas as U.S. Minister to France. Rhode Island did not send any delegates, true to its nickname, Rogue Island. Of the 55 delegates, only 39 and the witnessing secretary signed the document. George Washington and James Madison were the only signers who later became president. The oldest signer was Benjamin Franklin, who was 81. The youngest was Jonathan Dayton, who was only 26 years old. Constitution Day is celebrated on September 17th, the anniversary of the day the framers signed the document, even though the Constitution did not take effect until 9 months later, when it was ratified by 9 of the 13 states on June 21st, 1788. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where our subject is medical marijuana. You know, I don't think James Madison ever expressed an opinion on that particular topic, but I know a lawyer who has very strong opinions on the subject. Her name is Tamara Todd.
I'm a lawyer. I work for a nonprofit called the Drug Policy Alliance. It's a national organization based around the country. We have several state-based offices and a national office in D.C., and the goal of the organization is to change our nation's drug laws away from what was enacted under the drug war ideology and inject compassion and science and a health-based approach to the issues of drug use and drug addiction.
Since we have a constitutional focus, what we want to explore today is how can it be in our country that you have a federal government that prohibits marijuana criminally and a state government like California, but it's not alone, that allows it, at least in a medical context, and how does that work? I mean, how can we have two different governments telling us two different things, and what's a poor Californian to do? Can you explain
well,
that to us?
Well, it does get complicated. I mean, on a very basic level, you know, we do live in a country where citizens are controlled under dual sovereignty, meaning we have the state government and we have the federal government, and each has their own separate set of laws in many contexts. But in criminal law, there's state criminal laws and there's federal criminal laws, and the citizens of this country are governed and controlled by both.
Mm-hmm.
And one does not control the other. So, therefore, the federal government cannot tell the state what to criminalize under state law. And the federal government cannot tell the state or state officials to enforce the federal laws or to carry out the federal policy. So what that means is that the federal government can make marijuana illegal under federal law, but the state does not have to do the same under state law. And that's what we've seen in the context of medical marijuana, is states have said, starting with California in 1996, and now there's 16 states and the District of Columbia have said, we're not going to use our state criminal law and our state law enforcement resources to punish the use and the production and the distribution of marijuana for sick people, for people whose doctors have recommended to them under state law. The move is very significant, even though it remains illegal under federal law, because the vast majority of drug crimes and the vast majority of marijuana crimes are prosecuted by state and local officials. Probably 99% of those arrests and prosecutions are of state and local officials.
Now, that's important.
So when a state moves to repeal the state law penalties, they're actually working to protect a huge number of people.
Yeah, that. In fact, let me stop you there because that's extremely important. I mean, the federal government is, in some sense, the supreme government of the land. In fact, listeners to the show know that Article 6 of the Constitution specifically says that federal law is the supreme law of the land. And by extension, if there's a conflict between those two, state and federal law, the federal law is going to preempt the state law. Okay,
right.
That's the general constitutional context. But you've pointed out a very practical truth that really informs this whole discussion, which is that the federal government, although it might be supreme, does not have nearly the manpower, nearly the police power that the states do. And
no, they don't. And for the state, I mean, there's the federal government. Well, first, they don't have the political will to do it, but they also don't have the capacity to come into a state like California and start, arresting and prosecuting low-level marijuana offenses.
Yeah. So the Controlled Substances Act has outlawed marijuana for many years on a federal level, but it's very rare to see marijuana prosecutions in federal court.
Yes, it is. They also, in recent years, have had difficulty in some cases getting convictions once they're in front of a jury for marijuana offenses. Because the public at large has moved so much towards favoring legalization and not wanting to, send people to lengthy prison sentences in federal prison for marijuana crimes. So there's been some reluctance, I think, to bring those cases criminally. They've used other avenues to try and shut down some of these laws, but have been more reluctant to use criminal penalties. I'll just make one comment about the supremacy clause argument,
mm-hmm.
And that's that it's true that federal law is supreme, and if state law conflicts in a number of ways, it would be preempted by federal law. But the two sets of laws don't have to stand consistent in that the state has to make criminal what the federal has made criminal under federal law. The states, constitutionally, the states, don't have to be told by the federal government what to make criminal. Their policy in that regards of what to make criminal under state law and how to punish individuals under state law is completely within the state's purview.
Right, and that's an important distinction because, logically speaking, as you point out, the state doesn't have to criminalize the same thing the feds do, and that doesn't necessarily create an inconsistency.
Right. It doesn't. Yeah, the policies might be inconsistent, but not in a constitutionally significant way.
Right.
It's also that analysis is controlled by the language of the Controlled Substances Act, which, historically, actually all criminal law and definitely drug law was left up to the states almost completely. And when the federal government enacted the Controlled Substances Act and started moving into that area of starting to criminalize drug use and more crimes, they recognized that fact, and they wrote express language in the Controlled Substances Act about the conflict. And they basically said state law in the issue of drugs is not preempted unless it presents an actual conflict with federal law so that the two cannot stand together. And what that means is that an individual would be unable to comply with both sets of laws.
Okay, so the only way you'd actually get a conflict,
require the individual to violate federal law in some way.
Right, I was about to say that.
And that would be preempted.
If the state of California actually went out and started providing marijuana to school children in their lunches.
Exactly,
okay,
that would be
a conflict.
By federal law.
And that would be preempted by federal law, but the federal law has been very generous in trying to avoid such conflicts, and so the simple fact that California doesn't criminalize marijuana the same way the feds do, that's not a conflict.
Exactly, because any citizen of California, there's nothing requiring anyone in California to violate a federal law.
Okay, well, that takes care of the preemption.
If you engage in this activity, you're no longer going to be punished under state law, but the federal authorities still could come in and punish you under federal law.
It's your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about medical marijuana in California and in other states. After the break, we'll talk a little bit about what's happening this week at Montpelier. Then we'll talk some more to Tamara Todd. Stay tuned.
Public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
Not long ago in Oakland, California, I was asked by a group of children what to do if they were offered drugs. And I answered, just say no.
Drugs are menacing our society.
50% of Americans now say they want to legalize marijuana. When it goes to medical marijuana, that number goes up to 77%. What you see is the mainstream centrist position is to support legalizing marijuana.
Well, the war on drugs seen as a failure, but for some industries, the war on drugs is a profitable business. As the battle to crack down on minor drug offenses rages on, some companies are cashing in and getting rich.
Say, I dreamed about a reefer 5 feet long, a mighty mess, but not too strong. You'll be high, but not for long. If you're a viper, I'm the king of everything. I gotta be high before I swing. Let the bells ring, ding dong ding.
I'm feeling curious. I just wonder what's happening this week at Montpelier. Can you tell me, Kelly?
I think you're going to be surprised to hear this. Mud Camp comes to Montpelier.
Mud Camp?
Mud Camp.
What is
yes,
Mud Camp?
This is becoming such a fun tradition at Montpelier. Summer's almost out for the students, the week of June 2nd, and Montpelier is getting ready to welcome its rising 3rd through 6th graders for our annual Mud Camp. And each day, and it really earns its name, Mud, because kids come to Montpelier each day to get muddy, taking hikes, wading through streams, and playing outdoor games. And during the sessions are June 18th to the 22nd for the rising 5th and 6th graders. I'm sorry, for the rising 3rd and 4th graders.
Mm-hmm.
And the rising 5th and 6th graders are June 25th to the 29th. And it's a great way to come and learn about nature and all the different things that are going on in Montpelier.
Oh, man, my kids would have absolutely loved that. The very concept of just going out specifically to get muddy, they would have jumped at that.
Oh, it's amazing to watch these two. At the end of the day, some of our Montpelier colleagues will have their younger children go through mud camp, and at the end of the day, they come into the offices. Well, they're not allowed in the offices. They're actually kept outside, and they're from head to toe. These kids have a lot of fun.
And I'm betting, and I'm speaking to the parents now, this would be a wonderful way to really tire out your children, and I bet when they come home,
they're exhausted.
They are ready for bed.
Absolutely exhausted.
Well, not that we'd ever want to tire our children out, but if it's occurring to anybody, okay. So where can we go for more information?
Montpelier.org. You can learn about the two different sessions. And again, it's 4th graders June 18th to the 22nd and 5th and 6th graders June 25th to the 29th.
Montpelier.org. Thanks, Kelly Carmichael.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking with attorney Tamara Todd about medical marijuana in California and its constitutional implications.
States have moved into this arena in a responsible way and in order to meet a need in a way that, you know, best protects the community and best protects patients. But that's where we're seeing the issue of federal preemption arise, and it's under those state laws that we will probably ultimately see a court analysis.
Yeah, and that's very interesting because, of course, as I mentioned to you, I've also interviewed Steve D'Angelo, who is on the television show Weed Wars right now, and there's a whole series about his cannabis distribution center in near San Francisco. And that's where the preemption argument gets a little bit more of a close call, because while California is not requiring somebody like D'Angelo to produce marijuana, and it's not itself distributing the marijuana, the state is doing a lot of things that come awfully close to encouraging it. Simply by regulating it, simply by saying, okay, this is how these distribution centers are going to work, and by accepting tax money from them.
I think that's going to be an interesting thing. Actually, I think creating the regulation and control, is a more responsible approach.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, it doesn't obstruct the federal government, because the federal government could still come in and arrest and prosecute actors who have been licensed by the state or by the locality. I would posit that it doesn't actually create a conflict, a constitutionally significant conflict. But that's where the issue will be litigated. I mean, if you think about it, if you flip it around and you look at the analysis in terms of what if California had never criminalized marijuana at all under state law, that it had always been legal, possession, use, growing, distributing had always been legal. And then at this point of time, California said, you know, actually, I think the federal policy has something to it. I think maybe we should make all marijuana illegal under state law, except let's make a few narrow exceptions. We'll identify the people and make sure that sick people can still have access to it, so we won't use state law resources to punish those people, and created this narrow exception. That would be the same law, but it would actually be greatly assisting the feds. It wouldn't be looking like it was obstructing them. It would be, oh, look, now California is getting in line and doing a huge favor to help assist the feds in carrying out their marijuana prohibition policy. So if you look at it from that angle, which really isn't a different law, it's just a different starting point, mm-hmm. which would be legitimate for the state, you could see how the argument could be flipped around and saying, actually, you know, these regulations in some ways are not obstructing the federal policy. They're in some ways assisting it because it's a very narrow class. The individuals are identified. They're regulated. If the federal government still wants to come and prosecute them, they can. In fact, they're identified, you know, and is not preventing that in any way.
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up. Preemption is one of those doctrines that's deceptively simple to state, you know, that the federal mm-hmm. government is going to be supreme over the state governments if there's a conflict. But determining whether there is that conflict between state and federal laws, there are several different sub-doctrines, and some of them involve actual conflicts.
Right.
Others involve, you know, obstructing federal objectives. And there are all kinds of nuances there, and I think it's probably the simplest way to put it in lay terms is that there's lots of flexibility for a federal judge or a state judge to look at the situation and decide whether there is a conflict or not.
Yeah, there's some flexibility. I agree the doctrine is really complicated, and mm-hmm. it's difficult to analogize to other situations because mm-hmm. there's different categories of types of preemption, Congress can expressly preempt, or they could decide to occupy an entire field of regulation,
right.
in which case the state can't do anything without it being preempted. Here, I think the important piece here is that the preemption issue is controlled by the language of the Controlled Substances Act.
Yep.
So it's not necessarily analogous to other decisions on preemption or other preemption analyses in other areas of law that don't relate to drugs. Because here Congress had explicitly set out what the preemption standard is going to be in the Controlled Substances Act, and they've said it's going to be a state law is only preempted if it presents an actual conflict.
Yeah, that's extremely important. The actual language of the federal statute is extremely important in all of these cases. And it also brings up another constitutional issue that's sort of lurking in the background here, and I think you touched upon it a couple of minutes ago, and that is that traditionally criminal law has been pretty much the sole province of the states. You know, the states, essentially, they're the people who have the police forces. They're the people who have the criminal laws. And if you think about most crimes, and even on television, I mean, most crime dramas involve state prosecutors and state police forces of various types because most criminal laws are state laws. Now, that's changed. It started changing a lot during the 20th century, and this Controlled Substances Act and certainly its criminal provisions were part of that major shift, and perhaps that's what accounts for that preemption language, that very liberal preemption language in the Controlled Substances Act, is that the Congress recognized it was arguably intruding on an area that constitutionally was more appropriate for the states.
I think that's right. I think they recognized it, and I think their intent was actually to leave the vast majority of drug law enforcement up to the states.
Okay, well, then that's the constitutional background. Okay, so let's actually bring it up. Now that we understand the constitutional landscape, and I hope we've been clear enough for our listeners, I do, this is a complicated area, but now that we've got some idea, at least, of what the constitutional landscape is, what are the feds actually doing? Are they coming in and busting down doors of these cannabis distributors, or are they more or less hanging back and letting California do what it wants to do?
Well, they certainly have not been hanging back. They've taken, nationally, the approach has been different in different places. The one state that we've seen very aggressive enforcement arrests and prosecutions of actors who are in compliance with state law is in the state of Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, they carried out a coordinated number of raids. It was timed on the specific day that the Montana State Legislature was debating changes to the state law in the state capitol. And the Drug Enforcement Administration came in, raided providers across the state, arrested them, and are proceeding with the prosecutions in federal court. And many are being sent to federal prison for significant periods of time.
Wow.
In other states, in California and some other states, there's been a campaign of aggressive intimidation, I would say. So the U.S. attorneys in California have aggressively targeted providers that are in compliance with state and local regulation, some of the oldest and most well-regulated providers in the Bay Area, certainly, and have sent letters to the landlords who rent property to the dispensaries saying, if you don't evict the dispensary, we'll seize your property. And so that has succeeded in shutting down a number of very responsible providers who are regulated by the on the local level because their landlords aren't willing to take that risk. The interesting thing in California particularly, and particularly in Northern California with Melinda Haig, who's the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, is she's been seeking to target the most well-regulated and the most well-respected dispensaries. She's almost attacking regulation at its heart, which I think is very aggressive because she's not looking for just bad actors or people who are acting outside the system or growing and selling marijuana, you know, under the guise of it being medical marijuana. She's using her resources to target really the most legitimate, completely compliant, well-respected actors, and, you know, and doing things like subpoenaing documents from the San Francisco Department of Health about who is regulated within that city. And we've seen similar actions in other states. And then in some states, there's been no actions. New Mexico, that has the oldest, longest-running system of actual state licensing by the Department of Health of producers and distributors of marijuana, they've had no interference from the federal government.
Well, I have to introduce another concept here and another important legal concept that might clarify why there is such disparate treatment in these various places, and that's the concept of prosecutorial discretion. It's a long-standing doctrine that says, you know, that prosecutors have enormous leeway in deciding which laws and which people they're going to prosecute, which they're going to pursue, where they're going to use their resources. And so not only is there this disconnection between federal policy on the one side and state policy on the other, you've got all these U.S. attorneys who have their various territories, and each one of those attorneys, those U.S. attorneys, has discretion as to whether or not to get aggressive or not.
Right. That is true, and I think that those decisions are responsible for some of the disparate treatment. There's also, people feel, though, there is some coordinated effort coming from Washington, and part of that is that some of the attack in various states has been multi-agency.
Mm-hmm.
The IRS has started auditing places like Steve D'Angelo's dispensary, Harborside. We've seen even memos from the ATF saying, you know, medical marijuana patients can't get gun licenses. You know, then we've seen the Drug Enforcement Administration, the U.S. attorneys. In some sense, it seems like a very coordinated federal effort. You know, the thing with the Obama administration is that he made promises during his campaign about not interfering with state medical marijuana laws. And then after he came into office, his Department of Justice put out a memo saying that U.S. attorneys were not to use their discretion basically to target actors who are in compliance with state law. That certainly has not happened on the ground in the various states. In fact, like I said, Melinda Haig in Northern California has been targeting those who are most in compliance with state law. I mean, she's going regulation at the heart. And then we've also seen actions by U.S. attorneys that don't deal with prosecutions, but actually directly interject interference in the state process of enacting medical marijuana laws and implementing them. So they've sent letters to state legislators to state officials who are in the process of enacting a medical marijuana law or wanting to implement it, basically threatening letters about enforcing the Controlled Substances Act and intimidated those state officials out of passing a law or implementing a law.
Well, I know
so
that we're...
In this past year, we saw a law passed in Delaware for medical marijuana, and now the governor has said he's not going to implement it out of fear from a letter he received from the U.S. attorney.
Well, then constitutionally speaking, what we're seeing then is that the sleeping giant, the federal government, is flexing its muscle and is showing,
right.
that it really is supreme in this realm, and that it, one way or the other, whether through direct enforcement or these indirect threats,
right.
It's going to, use that power. But what do you account for this? How do you account for this since Obama came into office stating the opposite, that he wasn't going to be using federal resources on what many people, I'm sure you included, don't feel should be a federal priority?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, and there's different ideas that people have about it. I think that he's not willing to use his political chips to rein in law enforcement that is perhaps unhappy, and prosecutors who are perhaps unhappy with the fact that state law has a differing policy than federal law in their offices.
So you think this is just the president not controlling his own bureaucracy?
I think there's some limits on, like you said, prosecutor's discretion is strong. So he sets the policy, but it's obviously harder to probably get the various U.S. attorneys around the country to follow it.
Well, yes or no. I mean, ultimately, he could just give them pink slips. I mean, ultimately,
I'm not defending Obama in any regards. I think
right.
he should take a much more aggressive stance, and I think he should make it clear that his prosecutors certainly should not be bullying state law officials over what laws to enact and what laws to implement. I wanted to really quickly touch, since I know your show focuses on constitutional issues,
yeah.
one that we didn't discuss that I think is raised in the context of these U.S. attorney letters going to state officials, and that's the 10th Amendment issue.
Mm-hmm.
The 10th Amendment basically reserves the powers that are not given to Congress to the state. And there's a history of 10th Amendment cases, reserving the power of the state and enforcing the notion that the federal government cannot coerce state officials into implementing federal policy.
Ah, the Prince case, yeah.
Yeah, the Prince case, mm-hmm. exactly.
I don't mean to be cryptic. I should just mention the Prince case was that very famous case. I think it was in the late 1990s, where there was actually involved the Brady handgun control bill, and the federal government had written a statute that required local officials to do federal background checks. And the court rejected that, and it said, no, federal officials, you can't tell state officials what to do. And so you're saying that concept is relevant here because is that how you perceive these U.S. attorneys are more or less saying to the governors and the legislatures, don't legalize this stuff or we're going to come after you?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I think it gets very dangerously close to that line that they're using this strong arm tactic to ensure that the states don't repeal state law criminal penalties and continue to enforce basically the federal policy, even though the state has the desire to depart.
And that's our show today. Thanks very much to Tamara Todd, an attorney who specializes in the issues of medical marijuana, states' rights, federal preemption, all of that interesting constitutional stuff that comes up when you talk about medical marijuana. Thanks also to Steve D'Angelo of Weed Wars. Steve is in a really tough spot right now, running a cannabis distribution center. He and his family are very much at risk of federal prosecution. We appreciate them talking to us. One sad thing I've noticed and I'll share with you is that Weed Wars seems to have been canceled. It's no longer available on the Discovery Channel. You, of course, can get, I think, 4 episodes on the Internet, but it seems that the Discovery Channel is no longer going to be carrying Weed Wars. Too bad. Too bad for us, because that's a fascinating show. My name is Stuart Harris. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.